KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The plane is en route to The Hague in the Netherlands, allowing the former president to face charges of crimes against humanity in relation to his bloody war on drugs.
Former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has been sent to The Hague after being arrested in Manila under an ICC warrant for committing crimes against humanity in his deadly war on drugs. We'll speak to longtime Filipino human rights activist and scholar Walden Bello. But first, we look at President Trump's growing trade war as he imposes a sweeping 25% tariff on steel and aluminum imports. Plus, Texas Democratic Congress member Al Green, who was censured for protesting President Trump's congressional speech, has pledged to soon introduce articles of impeachment against Trump.
Impeachment is a remedy for a runaway president who believes that there are no guardrails, who believes that the Supreme Court has placed him above the law, and who is now very close to a point where he will not honor court orders.
We'll speak to attorney John Boniface of the Impeach Trump Again campaign. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ukraine has agreed to a Trump administration proposal for a 30-day ceasefire with Russia as the United States resumes military assistance and intelligence sharing with Kyiv. In exchange, Ukraine has agreed to sign a deal granting U.S. access to Ukraine's oil, natural gas, and mineral resources as soon as possible. President Volodymyr Zelensky said in his nightly video address to Ukrainians that he had accepted the deal following talks in Saudi Arabia.
During today's talks, the American side proposed taking a first step forward, establishing a full ceasefire for 30 days, not just stopping missiles, drones, and bombs, not just ensuring security in the Black Sea, but implementing a complete ceasefire along the entire front line. Ukraine welcomes this proposal. We see it as a positive and are ready to take this step.
U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said he would press Moscow to agree to the deal, adding, quote, "The ball is now in their court." Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said Russian officials are scrutinizing publicly released statements about the ceasefire proposal and did not rule out a phone call between Putin and Trump in the coming days. Overnight, Russia launched another wave of drone and missile attacks on Ukraine. One woman was killed, nine wounded in a Russian strike on Kryvyi Rih. While in the port city of Odessa, four Syrian sailors were killed when a Russian ballistic missile struck a vessel loading wheat for export to Algeria. Israel's military has stepped up attacks on the Gaza Strip, killing at least eight people over the past 24 hours, despite the ongoing ceasefire agreement. Among the dead are a Palestinian girl who was shot and killed by Israeli forces near Deir al-Balah, and four Palestinians killed in an airstrike near an Israeli checkpoint in central Gaza. This is the father of one of the victims.
Did we end the war or not? We don't know. Sometimes they say the first phase of the ceasefire has been extended, and sometimes they say the Israelis are not accepting the deal. We cannot say anything other than may God take revenge on those who caused this.
With Israel's total blockade of food, fuel, and humanitarian aid to Gaza now in its 12th day, the Gaza Bakers Union reports six of the territory's 22 remaining bakeries shut down after they ran out of cooking gas. On Tuesday, the charity MSF, Doctors Without Borders, strongly condemned the Israeli-imposed siege on the Gaza Strip, writing, quote, "Israeli authorities are yet again normalizing the use of aid as a negotiation tool. This is outrageous. Humanitarian aid should never be used as a bargaining chip in war," they said. On Tuesday, Israeli forces arrested dozens of people in the occupied West Bank, killing four people during raids around the city of Jenin. Among the victims is 58-year-old grandmother Faiza Ibrahim Abu Ghali, who was shot and killed when Israeli soldiers raided her home. Her 7-year-old grandson was reportedly among family members detained, then later released by Israeli forces. 14 members of Congress have signed a letter to Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem demanding the release of recent Columbia University graduate Mahmoud Khalil, a permanent resident of the U.S. who was arrested by immigration authorities for helping organize campus protests in solidarity with Palestinians. The 14 lawmakers, all Democrats, write, quote, Khalil's constitutional rights have been violated. He's been denied meaningful access to counsel and any visitation from his family. This is absolutely unacceptable and illegal, the letter said. On Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt argued Secretary of State Marco Rubio has broad authority under the Cold War-era Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1952 to declare someone deportable.
The administration believe that it needs to charge a green card holder with a crime to be eligible for deportation?
Well, in fact, Secretary Rubio reserves the right to revoke the visa of Mahmoud Khalil.
Khalil's attorneys are set to face off today in a New York court with Trump officials who want him deported. Khalil, who is being held at an ICE jail in Jena, Louisiana, will not be present at his hearing. On Tuesday, at least a dozen people were arrested in New York City as hundreds gathered to demand his release. Protests in solidarity with Khalil have spread to campuses nationwide. This is Graham Blair, a political science professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, where hundreds rallied on Tuesday.
Students are rightly scared, and I'm scared, frankly, because not only is the Trump White House deciding to target peaceful protesters because of their views about the war in Gaza and the complicity of our university in funding it, but they are being helped by university administrators around the country.
The House of Representatives has approved a short-term spending bill to keep the government funded through the end of September. One Democrat voted with 216 Republicans to approve the bill, which looks to slash $13 billion in non-military spending while boosting funds for veterans' health care and the Pentagon. Democratic Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries condemned the spending bill, saying it, quote, rips away life-sustaining health care and retirement benefits from everyday Americans.
It's all part of a broader scheme to pass massive tax cuts for billionaire donors, the wealthy, the well-off, and the well-connected, and then to stick working-class Americans with the bill. This entire scheme. And as Democrats, we want no part of it.
The bill now moves to the Senate, where it would need the support of at least 7 members of the Democratic caucus to pass. Without a continuing resolution, the government's poised to run out of money by the end of the day on Friday. The Department of Education has announced plans to fire an additional 1,300 workers, effectively cutting the agency's workforce in half since President Trump took office. Newly confirmed Education Secretary Linda McMahon, the billionaire former professional wrestling promoter, says the cuts show her commitment to efficiency and accountability. The National Teachers Union, the National Education Association, condemned the cuts, writing in a statement, quote, gutting the Department of Education will send class sizes soaring, cut job training programs, make higher education more expensive and out of reach for middle-class families, take away special education services for students with disabilities, and gut student civil rights protections, unquote. The European Union has responded swiftly after President Trump's 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum imports went into effect at midnight. The EU said it would impose counter tariffs on over $28 billion of U.S. goods starting in April. Trump's new tariffs also drew fire from Australia, though Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said his government would hold off for now on imposing reciprocal tariffs. On Tuesday, Trump backed down from threats to further increase U.S. tariffs on Canada by up to 50% and kept tariffs at the 25% rate after leaders of Ontario province suspended plans to raise rates on electricity sold to Michigan, Minnesota, and New York. Trump's escalated trade war rattled markets again on Tuesday, with the S&P 500 and NASDAQ indices posting their biggest one-day drop in over 2 years. On Tuesday, House Republicans added language to the House spending bill that effectively revokes Congress's ability to undo Trump's tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China anytime this year. We'll have more on this story after headlines. A House subcommittee hearing abruptly ended Tuesday after Texas Republican Congressmember Keith Self intentionally misgendered Democratic Congressmember Sarah McBride, who's the first transgender person to be elected to Congress, by introducing her as Mr. As McBride delivered her remarks, Democratic Congressmember Bill Keating interrupted, demanding Self to reintroduce McBride. This was their exchange.
I now recognize the representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ranking Member Keating, also wonderful.
Mr. Chairman, could you repeat your introduction again, please?
Yes, we have set the standard on the floor of the House, and I'm simply...
What is that standard, Mr. Chairman? Would you repeat what you just said when you introduced a duly elected representative from the United States of America, please?
I will. The representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride.
Mr. Chairman, you are out of order. Mr. Chairman, have you no decency?
Congressmember Self then adjourned the hearing and continued his transphobic attacks, writing on X, quote, "It is the policy of the United States to recognize two sexes, male and female," referring to an executive order signed by President Trump on his first day in office. Here in New York, more than 2,000 prison guards who joined a wildcat strike have been fired for failing to return to work by a Monday morning deadline set by an agreement between state officials and the guards union reached this weekend. New York Governor Kathy Hochul signed an executive order Tuesday banning the fired prison guards from future law enforcement and other civil service jobs in New York. The illegal strike led to dozens of state prisons to be placed on lockdown, with incarcerated people decrying worsening conditions inside. At least 9 prisoners died during the strike, including 22-year-old Messiah Nantwi, whose death is being investigated by a special prosecutor. 15 corrections employees were also placed on leave after witnesses said Nantwi was fatally beaten by a group of prison officers. As part of the agreement to end the strike, some prohibitions in New York's HALT Solitary Act, which stands for Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Solitary Confinement, were suspended. The law is meant to protect incarcerated people from being subjected to indefinite use of solitary confinement and was at the center of the wildcat strike led by prison guards who've long opposed the measure. A Texas appeals court has blocked the execution of David Wood just 2 days before he's set to be put to death by lethal injection. This is a major victory for the 67-year-old who has for decades maintained he was wrongfully convicted in the murders of 6 girls and young women in the El Paso area in 1987. Wood's lawyers have presented new evidence and have pleaded the court to allow for DNA testing that could prove his innocence. In Louisiana, a federal judge has temporarily halted the execution of Jesse Hoffman Jr., who is scheduled to be put to death next week using nitrogen gas. Hoffman's execution would have been the first to take place in Louisiana in 15 years. Hoffman's attorneys argued the planned use of nitrogen hypoxia, which would involve placing an industrial full-face mask on Hoffman, would violate the Constitution's 8th Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And in related news, South Carolina death row prisoner Brad Keith Sigmund was executed by firing squad Friday. This was South Carolina's first ever use of that execution method and the first firing squad execution in the United States in 15 years. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We turn now to President Trump's growing global trade war. Trump's imposed a sweeping 25% tariff on all steel and aluminum imports from around the world. The European Union's responded with retaliatory tariffs. European Commission Ursula von der Leyen said, quote, "We firmly believe that in a world fraught with geopolitical and economic uncertainties, it's not in our common interest to burden our economies with tariffs." Meanwhile, tension over trade remains high between the United States and Canada. On Tuesday, Trump backed off his threat to impose a 50% tariff on Canadian steel and aluminum. Trump made that threat after Ontario Premier Doug Ford added a 25% surcharge to electricity exports to three U.S. states. Ford then suspended the electrical surcharge after U.S. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick agreed to renewed trade talks. On Tuesday, Ontario Premier Doug Ford appeared on CNN and accused Trump of creating absolute chaos.
There was an unprovoked attack on Canada, on families, on jobs, on businesses. For what reason? The market's speaking loud and clear. Consumer confidence is down. The market's tumbling. You know, there's going to be plants closed in the U.S. Assembly plants will shut down because they won't have the aluminum, or they'll be paying twice, three times as much. This is absolute chaos created by one person, and that's Donald Trump, not the American people. I always say Canadians love Americans. I love Americans, and this has to stop.
Trump's escalating trade war rattled markets again on Tuesday, with stock markets continuing to fall. To talk more about Trump's trade policy, what many call Trump's trade war with the world, we're joined by the award-winning investigative journalist Dave Lindorf. His most recent article is Why U.S. Automakers Make Vehicles in Canada. It appears on his Substack page. This can't be happening. Dave, thanks so much for being with us. Why don't you start off by just responding to what Trump is doing to Canada and the 25% tariffs on steel around the world?
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me on. I'm in Cambridge, so you found me. the whole issue that really struck me about this is that the reason that the auto industry and probably a lot of the steel market went to Canada, and that the auto industry actually set up subsidiaries in Canada to construct the cars that they sell, some of them, all the vans, pretty much minivans, and a noted Ford and GM pickup, is because Canadian labor costs them much less. And it doesn't cost them much less because Canadian workers earn less per hour, which they don't. They have good, strong unions, and they have good hourly pay. But they don't have to, those subsidiaries don't have to pay for their employees' healthcare costs. In the U.S., in contrast, the union has very good, negotiated very good health plans from the auto industry, Ford, Stellantis, and GM, but they have to pay for that themselves, the auto companies, and a part of it by the employees, because we don't have public medicine, nationally funded public medicine for working age people, only for people on Medicaid after they're 65. They're not the ones that are working. So the fact that we don't have national health care here like they have in Canada or Britain or all of Europe is making American industry non-competitive. In fact, Rick Wagoner told the Senate back in 85 that GM was being driven almost into bankruptcy because of healthcare costs. And now healthcare costs cost about, I think, $4.9 trillion, a 6-something percent of the U.S. economy, or 16, rather. So we're really paying double for not having national healthcare. We don't have, we have to pay for it ourselves, partly, and we lose our jobs because our industry is not competitive with world other, you know, other industries.
And Dave, you make the point in your article that it's not just Canada. In Germany, in Japan, in South Korea, in France, China, many other countries that manufacture automobiles have some kind of government-paid health insurance. And in places like Germany, the auto workers make much more money than auto workers here in the United States. But those companies, the production of cars there is still competitive.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the irony one is that if we had, say, what Bernie Sanders has been pushing for, you know, several elections, presidential elections and off-year elections, of Medicare for all, you know, sort of expanded and Medicare for all, so everybody got what old people now get, so some form of socialized medicine. Not only would workers benefit because they would have even the money that they're getting would go further because they wouldn't be having to pay for deductibles and co-pays and things that don't even get covered because it would all be covered by tax supported national healthcare. The companies that they work for wouldn't be laying them off because they can't sell things. And so, you know, it's a win-win situation, which I don't understand how, except for the corruption of our campaign funding system, why Republicans and the neoliberals who control the Democratic Party would think that it's a good idea not to do this. But they don't, they're blocking it, both of those groups.
And Dave, could you talk about this whole effort of Trump to especially raise tariffs on Mexico and Canada, both of which are members of the U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade agreement that he negotiated and that he called a great agreement several years ago?
That's right. That's right. He said it was a great agreement, and now he's breaking it. I mean, it's a pretty astonishing thing. And so... But, you know, I think it's incumbent on the working class at this point to call it with their own senators and representatives, because they're not voting in the interests of working people if they don't, you know, support the idea of Medicare for all.
I think this is absolutely key. It can't be said enough, this whole issue of Medicare for all, Dave Lindorf. When there's this whole discussion, for example, about cuts to Medicaid, about cuts to health care in general, and the Democrats are really focusing on this, which is crucial, what they don't say, what they don't talk about is universal health care, is Medicare for all. Can you talk more about that, about this being the moment we see Bernie Sanders and his, you know, oligarchy tour around the country continually hammering home on this, but it hardly hits the corporate media radar screen, perhaps because they have so many health insurance and drug company advertisements?
Yeah, it's really true. I wrote a book about this year, like back in 1992, about the for-profit medicine and what was wrong with it, and it hasn't changed. It's gotten worse. The idea that you have none of the administrative costs that are built in, at like as much as 30% of all the trillions of dollars spent on healthcare in the United States goes to administrative costs. It doesn't do a thing. It is the insurance company is sucking up the profits for no purpose. They're just sort of vultures or parasites sucking up the money in between the treatment and the payment. So it makes no sense at all.
This is UAW President Sean Fain speaking on ABC's This Week.
Look, We're in a crisis mode in this country. You know, there is no single issue in this country that has affected our economy and working class people and their jobs than NAFTA, the USMCA, and our trade laws, our broken trade system. And we're in a crisis mode. And, you know, we are triaging right now. So I hear this debate about, you know, blanket tariffs and all this stuff. But look, we're in a triage situation. Tariffs are an attempt to stop the bleeding from the hemorrhaging of jobs in America for the last 33 years. So, you know, and as we speak right now, I mean, decisions are still being made. Warren Truck Plant right here in Michigan, there's over 2,000 people laid off. And a simple decision, Stellantis is shifting truck production to Mexico. They could change overnight and move those trucks right back here to Warren, Michigan, and put people back to work. You know, you have Deere workers in Racine, Wisconsin. We have Mack truck workers in Allentown, Pennsylvania, where the companies saying are going to move their jobs to Mexico. So tariffs aren't the end solution, but they are a huge factor in creating and fixing this problem.
So that's the UAW president, Sean Fain. Dave Lindorf, if you can respond to that. And also, go ahead.
Yeah, he's not addressing the issue because he knows that the reason that the industry moved construction into Canada is because of healthcare costs. I mean, that was stated by their executives. And the unions are not good on this because they actually... you know, the leadership of the unions actually likes having, especially when they're strong, like to be able to point to the healthcare benefits that they've negotiated. But those are coming off of the pay of the workers, because even if it's partly paid by the company could be paying wages instead of insurance premiums to private insurance companies. So it's really a compromised situation for the leadership in unions. They should be supporting state-funded healthcare so that they can focus on working conditions and better incomes, and not on this other stuff. So a tariff. The worst thing about the tariffs, and that he also should know this, is it's the most regressive form of taxes, because it hits the people who have to buy stuff that's got tariffs on it, from like imported food, medicines, all of that. And second of all, it's a way of keeping the bad American practices, and, you know, investing, for example, in productivity improvements in your company, when if you can get a tariff slapped on the competition abroad, you don't have to make those investments. So it's really a way of keeping the management of companies doing whatever they're doing now instead of fixing things.
Up on that, the emphasis that Trump has, how different governments or countries are ripping off the United States when it comes to trade, when in fact, I think the estimates are that as much as 2/3 of all trade in the world is between multinational companies trading with their own subsidiaries. This is an internal system of the division of labor among the big multinationals. It's the companies, the American companies, that go to China, that go to Vietnam, that go to Bangladesh to produce their products. It's not the nations themselves that are responsible. It's the way that international multinational corporations work.
Yeah, you're right, Juan. They do that also because they get enormous tax breaks by manipulating the internal pricing of their subsidiary supplied parts coming into the U.S. So if you can make the profits show up in the country that has the lowest corporate tax on profits, and you do it by just artificially increasing the cost of the product that you're buying from yourself, from a high-plex tax place to a low tax place. And it's very hard to detect that.
Finally, Dave Lindorf, I want to ask you about the Tesla ad that President Trump performed in yesterday at the White House. It was quite astounding. You have, what's the article I'm reading right now? The president throwing Elon Musk a lifeline with an event live streamed on X where he touted the cars and said he would buy one. You have Trump going into a red Tesla as Elon Musk was there with his little son, X, talking about how important it was to support Tesla. Can you talk about not only the stock massive drop in Tesla, but the billionaires who stood at the inauguration in front of the cabinet members losing a tremendous amount of money at this point since the inauguration?
Yeah, I mean, what he's doing is he's helping him because his market is collapsing around the world. People don't want to buy Teslas from, you know, this lunatic fascist, you know, drug user, and he's angering the MAGA people. He's angering foreign buyers who would buy this. People, you know, and the Teslas are being attacked. So if you buy a Tesla, you're liable to get key scratches on your car when you park it. And, you know, worse. So, you know, I think he's lost, like, the last time I looked, it was $129 billion since the election, his Tesla companies and his other companies. So, yeah, I mean, so Trump is trying to give him a boost. It's pretty obscene. He should put him in a red Tesla and launch him to Mars.
But you would have to be very careful that the rocket doesn't explode. And what I'm referring to, of course, is the second explosion of one of Elon Musk's rockets, this one over the Caribbean. Dave Lindorf, I want to thank you for being with us, award-winning investigative journalist, author of the recent book, Spy for No Country, the story of Ted Hall, the teenage atomic spy who may have saved the world. Dave Lindorf's most recent article on Substack, Why U.S. Automakers Make Vehicles in Canada. Coming up, attorney John Boniface of the Impeach Trump Again campaign. And then we'll look at what's happened to the former Philippine President Duterte, flown to The Hague. He's been arrested. Stay with us. The Circle by Salt. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. More than a quarter of a million people have signed a petition to support an impeachment investigation of President Donald Trump, who was twice impeached during his first term. The Impeach Trump Again campaign is being led by the group Free Speech for People. This comes as Texas Democratic Congressmember Al Green has threatened to soon introduce new articles of impeachment against Trump. Last week, Congressmember Green was removed from the House floor for protesting Donald Trump's congressional address. He was then censured by the House. Green spoke on Democracy Now! Friday.
Impeachment is a remedy for a runaway president who believes that there are no guardrails, who believes that the Supreme Court has placed him above the law, and who is now very close to a point where he will not honor court orders. When he does that, Ms. Goodman, he at that point will become a dictator. We are this close. When he goes over that line, that second, that scintilla of a second, he will become a dictator, and we will be under a dictatorship. I refuse to wait until that happens before I act. So I will act in defense of the Constitution and for the people of this country.
We're joined now by John Boniface, president of Free Speech for People, organizing the Impeach Trump Again campaign during Trump's first term. He co-authored the book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. So he was impeached twice during the first term. We're not even talking about 100 days into his second term. Why, John?
Thank you, Amy, for having me. We're launching this campaign because we believe it's critical that we invoke this impeachment clause of the Constitution at this moment in history. This president has already committed multiple abuses of power since assuming the presidency. And the framers designed the Constitution to ensure that we would not have a monarch or a tyrant govern this nation. They set up three co-equal branches of government, the Congress, the executive branch, the judiciary, but they also put in this extra guardrail, the impeachment clause. And it's designed to deal with that lawless president who abuses the power of the office. And those multiple abuses of power keep piling up every day. We've documented at ImpeachTrumpAgain.org many of these abuses, including his abuse of the pardon power, where he, on day one, effectively pardoned 1,500 of his fellow insurrectionists who had attacked the Capitol on January 6, 2021 to try to stop the peaceful transfer of power. We have also documented the way in which he issued an executive order to end birthright citizenship. We know that this is a constitutional right. You cannot erase a part of the Constitution with an executive order. Two separate federal courts have found this to be unconstitutional, but it's also an abuse of power. He's usurped the power of Congress by freezing funds that have been duly appropriated by Congress. Only Congress has the power to appropriate funds, and he's gone ahead and frozen those funds. And now courts have demanded that he release those funds, and he's defying those court orders, an attack on the judiciary, an attack on the Congress. The list goes on. And the point of the impeachment power is to ensure that we do not have this kind of lawlessness coming out of the Oval Office, and that's why we launched this campaign.
But John, how would you respond to critics who, even though they may agree with you on the violations of by Trump, say that in the last two impeachments, when Democrats had a majority in Congress, they could not move forward against Trump. Now, with Republicans in charge of both houses, this will virtually not go nowhere.
Well, Juan, the important point here is to start building the case for why this president must be impeached and removed from public office. The fact is that when we see these abuses of power, we have to invoke this impeachment clause. You know, we know the votes are not going to be there today to start impeachment proceedings. But the point is that we as a people must demand that our members of Congress stand up and defend our Constitution at this critical moment in history. We commend Congressman Al Green for standing up and demanding that impeachment proceedings begin against this president. And we believe all members of Congress who still believe in the Constitution and our democracy must stand with him.
And in terms of what would be the next steps, let's say you keep building this petition, what would be the, I know Congressman Green has said he would introduce articles of impeachment, but what would be your sense of whether you're having some progress on this issue?
Well, first, we see the progress with the 250,000 plus people who've already joined this campaign in less than 2 months, signing up at ImpeachTrumpAgain.org. Org, and we want those numbers to continue to grow, and we believe they will. But Congressman Green has pledged that he will introduce articles of impeachment, and we're working with him and his office on that. And when he does so, they can be a privileged resolution requiring a floor vote, as he did in 2017. He was the first member of Congress to stand up in the last Trump administration. And we will see those numbers grow as well. Members of Congress will have to be put on record with a floor vote on articles of impeachment as to where they stand. Do they stand on the side of the Constitution and their oath to protect the Constitution and our democracy, or do they stand on the sidelines in the face of this lawlessness from the Oval Office?
Before you go, John, you're also working on other issues like abolishing super PACs. I think that Elon Musk has promised to raise something like, or he's attempting to raise $100 million for three pro-Trump super PACs. Of course, he could just give that himself as the world's richest man.
Yes, it's important to remember that super PACs did not get created by the Supreme Court. People think it got created out of Citizens United, and that's not true. Super PACs were created by a federal appeals court ruling out of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which wrongly held that because, in their view, independent expenditures cannot corrupt, that unlimited donations to political action committees cannot corrupt. That's patently untrue, as we now know. 15 years after that decision, we see the history of how unlimited donations to super PACs from the Elon Musks and others have dominated our elections and corrupted the political process. So we are engaged with others in working to abolish super PACs. And the state of Maine recently passed a ballot initiative. 74% of the voters enacted it to abolish super PACs in their state elections. Professor Lawrence Lessig of Harvard Law School was a catalyst for this initiative, along with his group Equal Citizens. And we're working with him and the state attorney general's office to help defend that critical law and create a new test case for the opportunity to abolish super PACs nationwide.
Axios is reporting Elon Musk has told the White House he plans to give $100 million to President Trump's political operation.
It's rampant corruption. It's absolutely an obscene situation that we have now, where billionaires have this opportunity to dominate our government and our politics, and we have to put an end to it. And abolishing super PACs is one important step forward, and we believe there will be congressional legislation soon to be introduced that will deal with that as well.
And the role of Hawaii, what they're doing as a model as you see it?
So in Hawaii, the state Senate just unanimously and with bipartisan support passed our model legislation to end multinational corporate spending. This is another whole problem with our system of money and politics, which allows foreign influence corporations to now dominate our politics and send through the corporate form foreign investment into our politics. So Hawaii has passed this model legislation that we've been advancing across the country through the state Senate, and now it's on to the Hawaii House, and we hope Hawaii will become the next state to pass this law.
John Boniface, I want to thank you for being with us. President of Free Speech for People, the group's petition to impeach Trump again, has gathered 250,000-plus signatures. Coming up, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has been sent to The Hague after he was arrested under a warrant from the International Criminal Court for committing crimes against humanity. Stay with us. A Warm Place by Nine Inch Nails. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the Philippines. Former President Rodrigo Duterte is being flown to The Hague after being arrested in Manila Tuesday for crimes against humanity on an international criminal court warrant. The ICC has been investigating Duterte since 2018 over his extrajudicial so-called war on drugs that the UN estimates killed over 8,600 people. Human rights groups in the Philippines say the death toll is more like 30,000 people. Many children are among those killed. Last year, the former president admitted under oath that he oversaw a death squad of gangsters while he served as mayor of the southern city of Davao.
I have a death squad, seven of them, but they are not the police. They were gangsters. I command one of the gangsters, kill that, because if you don't, I will kill you.
Duterte, now 79 years old, served as prosecutor, vice mayor, then mayor of Davao before serving as the president of the Philippines from 2016 to 2022. Back in 2016, he compared himself to Hitler, saying he'd be happy to slaughter 3 million drug addicts.
Hitler massacred 3 million Jews. Now, there is 3 million, there's a 3 million drug addicts. There are. I'd be happy to slaughter him. At least, if Germany had Hitler, the Philippines would have, but, you know, my victims, I would like to be all criminals.
The ICC's arrest warrant relates to alleged extrajudicial killings that occurred between 2011 to 2019. Although the Philippines withdrew as a member of the ICC in 2019, the court retains jurisdiction over crimes committed before that date. Duterte's family has condemned his arrest, demanding his return to Manila. The former president's daughter, Sara Duterte, is the current vice president of the Philippines and political rival of the current president, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. She's headed to The Hague to support her father. Speaking outside the airbase in Manila Tuesday, she described his arrest as oppression and persecution.
There is no legal basis at all to turn over or to endorse the president, the former president, to ICC. So, wala silang...
If they're looking for justice, there's no justice here.
Meanwhile, families of the victims of Duterte's so-called drug war organized candlelight vigils, prayer meetings, gatherings to mark his arrest. Emily Soriano, the mother of a 15-year-old boy who was killed in one of Duterte's crackdowns in 2016, called for more accountability at an emotional news conference earlier today in Manila.
Duterte was able to get due process, but when my child was killed, there was no due process. He sleeps in a nice bed while my child is rotting at the cemetery. It's been 8 years, almost 9 years, since my son became a victim of Duterte's war on drugs.
For more on this historic arrest of the former president of the Philippines, we're joined right now by Walden Bello, acclaimed Filipino scholar, co-founder of Focus on the Global South. He served in the House of Representatives of the Philippines and was a key figure in the international movement to restore democracy in the Philippines in the 70s and 80s. His new memoir is Global Battlefields, Memoir of a Legendary Public Intellectual from the Global South. Walden Bello is joining us from Seattle, the first stop on his U.S. book tour. He also has events in San Francisco, Washington, and here in New York this month. Walden Bello, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the significance of Duterte being arrested and flown to The Hague for crimes against humanity?
Well, Amy, first of all, thank you for inviting me to Democracy Now! It is really a monumental step in the dispensation of justice. I mean, we are talking about a killer, a person who killed at least 27,000 people over his 6 years, plus many more while he was mayor of Davao City down south. So the ICC is, you know, measure, you know, of issuing this warrant of arrest and flying Duterte to The Hague is very important, not only for Filipinos and the families of those who whose lives he took, but it is a warning to others, you know, that, you know, eventually justice will catch up with you. And I think there are outstanding warrants of arrest that are aimed at Netanyahu of Israel as well as the dictator of Burma. So it's a very important step that we have seen in terms of Duterte's being arrested and being sent to The Hague. And as was mentioned by, you know, the mother of one of the victims, he is being given due process, and he will be given, hopefully, a speedy trial, you know, and this is a due process is something that he never gave his victims. And I think it is important to say that this fellow is unrepentant. He doesn't you know, he doesn't repent for, you know, all the thousands of deaths that he caused. So, you know, so it's time justice caught up with him.
And Walden, could you talk about the impact within the Philippines, the decision by President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. to allow this arrest to go forward? Meanwhile, the vice president, Duterte's daughter, is now going to be leading his defense, the defense of her father?
Yes. Well, basically, there is a dynastic warfare that is going on between the Duterte family and the Marcos family. They were in alliance, you know, up to several months back, but they've fallen out. And so fact is that when it signed the Rome Treaty, establishing the International Criminal Court, the Philippine government or the Philippine state took upon itself the obligation to enforce the ICC's mandates around arresting and trying human rights violators. And that's a permanent duty. Whoever is the power holder or the temporary holder of, you know, Philippine power. So the way that I would look at it is, despite the dynastic warfare that is going on, this was the fulfillment of a duty incurred by the Philippine state when it signed the Rome Treaty. So all the, you know, it has been a very meticulous legal process, the investigation plus the warrant of arrest. And the Marcos government had no choice but, in fact, to enforce it because all the appropriate steps had been taken by the ICC, and the Marcos government would not have, you know, would have been not fulfilling its contractual obligations to international law, to the ICC, if it had not moved. So the way that I look at this is that, you know, this is really something that the Philippine government had, in fact, to take because of its duties to international law.
What about this whole issue that Duterte had withdrawn the Philippines from the ICC in 2019 in a move that his critics condemned as a way of trying to shield himself from accountability?
Yes, that was, in fact, the purpose was to try to shield himself from accountability. But what the ICC is investigating is from the time the Philippines joined the Rome Treaty in 2011, up to 2019, it has jurisdiction over what Duterte did during that period. So this is well within the rights of the ICC to, in fact, investigate and prosecute Duterte, because the Philippines, during that time, from 2011 to 2019, before the withdrawal, all human rights violations that were carried out during that time, the ICC had jurisdiction over.
On Tuesday, families of drug war victims held a prayer vigil in Manila following Duterte's arrest.
Through our prayers and the people who helped us, we did not expect to achieve something like this, to see a president, someone like Duterte, receive a warrant of arrest. This is only the start of our fight. Our justice has not yet been achieved because there's still a lot of things that will happen, but we will not stop fighting.
So, Walden Bello, I wanted to take this broader, and it's something you mentioned when you first responded to his arrest. The executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Trita Parsi, wrote on social media, quote, "Perhaps Netanyahu and Gallant will be next," referring, of course, to the current prime minister of Israel and the former defense minister. Mm-hmm. And here in New York, CUNY professor Danny Shaw similarly asked, "Why don't they arrest Netanyahu?" If you could talk about this as a model, I'm referring to bringing leaders to justice in an international court, and also then talk about the United States. We had Maria Ressa in a few years ago, head of Rappler, who is constantly being attacked by Duterte. And she said, don't just look at what's going on in the Philippines as what's happening in a foreign country. We're just a few years ahead of you, she said, in the United States.
Well, yes, I mean, this is a big step forward. As I said, it was monumental in its implications. So this is a step that could be followed with respect to other human rights violators like Netanyahu and Gallant the dictator in Myanmar. This step should be taken and moved at this point internationally. The ICC undertook this investigation and pressure on the Philippines for a long period of time. And it had, the support of people in the Philippines. And I think it is really, the fact that people in the Philippines wanted to see justice done that led to the events of March 11. Without that internal pressure coming in or acting on the Philippine government, this would not, have happened. So it's a combination of both internal domestic pressure plus international pressure. Coming together. Many people in the Philippines really poured a lot of effort into this over the years, journalists, lawyers, and so it's an accumulation of resistance, an accumulation of demands for justice, people throughout the world, so many supported this effort. It's not just the ICC and its legal process, but so many, in fact, as Maria Ressa and others have, in fact, seen. So I would say that we in the Philippines are very grateful for the international support that was shown in this effort to bring a human rights violator to The Hague. And I think the other thing is that we've got to have all those countries that haven't signed yet to sign the Rome Statute, and that includes the United States. There have been quite a number of people who have violated human rights, engaged in widespread systematic repression that have to be brought to justice. And on the part of people in the United States, there has to be that pressure to get the United States to move and sign the Rome Statute establishing the ICC.
Weldon Bello, we want to thank you so much for being with you. Look forward to seeing you when you're here in New York. Weldon is acclaimed Filipino scholar, activist, co-founder of Focus on the Global South, served in the House of Representatives of the Philippines, key figure in the international movement to restore.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.